In his annual meeting with the 175 ambassadors accredited to the Holy See, Pope Benedict has outlined his key concerns regarding situations of conflict and injustice in the world and urged all those in positions of power to promote peace, development, and respect for human dignity. Issues of debt, trade, and international aid to the least developed nations figured high in his speech to the diplomats on Monday, a speech which is considered a kind of state of the world address to be closely monitored by governments and political leaders across the globe.
Le scandale de la faim qui tend à s'aggraver est inacceptable dans ce monde qui dispose des biens, des connaissances, et des moyens d'y mettre un terme.
Speaking in French to the ambassadors, Pope Benedict said the worsening scandal of hunger is unacceptable in a world which has the resources, the knowledge, and the means available to bring it to an end. It impels us, he said, to change our way of life, and it reminds us of the urgent need to eliminate the structural causes of global economic problems, respecting both the environment and the need for integral human development.
Ils font donc souhaiter la reprise des négociations commerciales du Doha Development Round de l'Organisation mondiale du commerce.
In particular, the Pope called for a swift implementation of commitments taken by the international community in trade talks, urging a resumption of the so-called Doha development negotiations and an acceleration of efforts to reduce or cancel the debts owed by the poorest nations. Another area of concern, the Pope said, is the vast movement of people leaving their native lands to flee conflicts or seek better living conditions. It's an illusion, he stressed, to think that migration can be blocked by force. Rather, the problem, he said, must be addressed humanely, with justice and with compassion.
Affronté avec humanité, justice et compassion.
Another global concern Pope Benedict pointed to was what he called continuous attacks on life from conception to natural death, even in places such as Africa, with a traditional culture of respect for family life. On the African continent, the Pope spoke of the drama of Darfur in western Sudan, which risks spreading to the neighbouring nations of Chad and the Central African Republic.
Le drame du Darfur se poursuit et s'étend aux régions frontalières du Tchad et de la République centrafricaine.
The Pope said the international community has seemed powerless for almost 4 years to end this humanitarian crisis, and he urged all those involved to act with determination to stop the suffering of so many innocent people.
You know, people on the ground are afraid to really say what's going on because they're afraid of repercussions from whatever armed groups that might be involved.
Nancy McNally is media officer for the Global Catholic Confederation Caritas Internationalis. She's just returned from a visit to Darfur, where she witnessed firsthand the extreme difficulties and frustrations facing all those trying to help the millions of victims of this conflict. She told my colleague Chris Altieri about the risks it poses to the surrounding region.
There's a huge amount of tension because people know that there's been a build-up of arms and armed groups and military infrastructure. So the feeling is that at any moment there might be, you know, just one spark could set off a huge, a wider conflict.
And in that wider conflict, how many people would face loss of life or property?
It's hard to say how many people. I mean, right now I think there are about 4 million people who are essentially dependent on humanitarian aid. Most of those people are living in camps for displaced people. Or they're being housed with maybe some family or friends or other families. I think even in some of the cities that I, some of the towns that I saw when I was in Darfur, there were I think 40,000 people in one camp alone outside one of the main towns in West Darfur, and that was just one camp of about 5 different camps around the town. So, you know, if you just say, okay, 40,000, maybe there are 100,000 people around that one town in West Darfur that if something were to happen and wide-scale violence broke out, then essentially, they people were telling me they just run for the hills. And at that point, if they run for the hills, they're an easy target for anybody.
In the camps themselves, though, what are the major difficulties? And I mean, beyond the logistics.
The major problem is access. When I was there, just more and more huge tracts of land and area outside of the main towns was becoming inaccessible to NGO workers. Anytime, even when I was there, anytime we had to move from one place to another, whatever we were doing, a lot of times we didn't end up doing it because we were told that there was a security situation on the road, there was a security situation in the towns. We couldn't go past a certain camp for displaced people because there was a huge amount of tension at the time. So, again, just roads were closed off. We didn't have access for days at a time. And we spent a lot of time kind of in the main towns, at most going from kind of our guest houses and to the office and back. You know, at this moment, and increasingly so, there are fresh displacements of people coming in from different areas. One of the areas that we were close to was the Jebel Mara, and overnight, every night, people were arriving in these camps for displaced people that were already overstretched with their resources. They were already struggling to supply people with fresh water, basic food and water hygiene kits, and essential items. I mean, these people don't even have a roof over their heads, clearly. So whenever we could, we would be going out to the IDP camps and bringing these basic items, even sheeting, so people can put, you know, plastic sheet over their heads until they can do something else. But when you have hundreds and even, I heard even thousands of people showing up in these IDP camps overnight, again, we didn't always necessarily have access to those people. We couldn't get to those people. Everybody's struggling to provide them with what they can. But again, they're going into places where the resources are already extremely stretched.
Caritas Internationalis media officer Nancy McNally there. Elsewhere in Africa, Pope Benedict called for peace in Uganda and in the Horn of Africa, where hostilities have resumed recently, noting an overall strengthening of Africa's continental and regional institutions. The Pope welcomed in particular positive moves towards democracy and reconciliation in Burundi and the Democratic Republic of Congo.
En particulier, la conclusion de la phase de transition politique au Burundi et plus récemment en République démocratique du Congo.
In Latin America, Pope Benedict spoke of his forthcoming pastoral journey to Brazil next May and praised various positive developments across the continent, including better access to education, efforts to reduce poverty and unemployment, and the commitment to combat drug trafficking and corruption. In particular, he appealed for greater efforts to end the humanitarian crises in Colombia and Haiti, and he urged Cuban authorities to open up the country to the outside world.
Que Cuba s'ouvre au monde et le monde au Cuba.
Speaking to the diplomats about the continent of Asia, Pope Benedict turned his attention to the small Christian communities in countries like China, Vietnam, and India, where he said they should be allowed to live and act in a climate of religious liberty. On the Korean peninsula, he spoke of the dangerous sources of tension, which must be resolved through negotiation to ensure a united and nuclear-free country, which would bring benefits to the entire region. In Afghanistan, Pope Benedict deplored the recent increase in violence and terror attacks there. And in Sri Lanka, he voiced his deep concerns for the failure of negotiations between the government and the Tamil Tiger Liberation Front waging a long-running campaign for independence. Despite a ceasefire brokered by Norway in 2002, thousands of combatants and civilians die each year in the island nation, and the conflict shows signs of spreading further. This is how Catholic human rights activist and executive director of Sri Lanka's National Peace Council, Yehan Pereira, analysed a recent attack by the military in the northwestern district of Manar.
The attack in Manar is a sign that The conflict is not simply limited to the east of the country, as we had been hoping it would be, but is also now spreading to the north. North and east being the contested part of the country, which the LTTE is claiming as a separate Tamil homeland. It is very distressing that the fighting now is going to spread to the north, because this means that there is no hope of a quick end to the conflict. Because if it had been limited to the east, then because the government has more or less obtained control over large parts of the east, we could have hoped that the fighting would cease in the east, and then maybe the two sides would go back to the negotiating table. But if the government is extending its operations to the north, then we are looking forward to a long period of escalated fighting.
And what is happening? The government forces are saying that they didn't target a civilian area, yet 6 of the dead were children, over 30 were wounded, and 14 were killed in these airstrikes, and they were civilian deaths. So what is the situation with targeting?
I'm quite sure the government never intended to bomb civilians. They probably, as the government has been saying, they probably targeted an LTTE camp or base. But even more sophisticated militaries than the Sri Lankan ones, such as the U.S. military, have, when they launch airstrikes, bombed wrong targets. And it seems that the same thing has happened in Sri Lanka. In addition, the LTTE is also well known to use the civilian population as human shields. So I don't know what happened in Manna, but the LTTE has used this tactic in the past. And also, on the other hand, the Sri Lankan military, the Air Force, is not a very sophisticated one. So it very well could aim in one place and bomb in another.
The United Nations has again urged the Sri Lankan military and Tamil Tigers to stop the fighting, urging the resumption of the peace process. Do you think that'll work? Do you think there can be a resumption of the peace process?
I don't think the UN statement, this particular statement by itself, is going to change the direction of the two parties. But what I see is that the opposition to this war is now coming primarily from abroad, from the international community, because within Sri Lanka, there is no viable, strong political movement that is opposing the war in the Sinhalese majority areas. Of course, the Tamil people, I'm sure they don't want the war, but they have no voice because they are living under dictatorship of either the LTTE or the Sri Lankan military. So there is no democracy in those parts. In the parts where democracy prevails, there is no viable alternative to the present government strategy. This is the tragedy of Sri Lanka. So the opposition is coming from abroad. Up to now, it has not been effective in causing the two sides to stop their military practices.
Do you think this pressure from abroad, maybe pressure or influence from abroad, do you think it could have a positive effect?
Well, I'm hopeful it would have, because the government will become increasingly aware that maybe the international community, which has up to now penalized the LTTE very heavily by banning it, might also choose to penalize the Sri Lankan government in some parallel fashion, or else reverse the penalties or the penalization of the LTTE. It is possible that also could happen. In addition, there is a possibility that within the domestic political situation, that there could be a realignment of political forces because of this danger of the military escalation. And that the domestic changes could get the government to change its strategy. That's a possibility, but nothing at the moment is sure. What seems to be on the table for the next few weeks, at least, is continuing military action.
Yehan Pereira, Executive Director of Sri Lanka's National Peace Council, speaking to my colleague Lydia O'Kane. Speaking of the situation in the Middle East, Pope Benedict underlined his continuing anxiety over the conflicts which plague that region. The Holy See, he said, will never tire of reiterating that armed solutions achieve nothing, as we saw in Lebanon this past summer. Underlining the rights of Israelis to live in peace and of Palestinians to live in a free and sovereign homeland, the Pope urged all parties involved in what he called the complex political chessboard of the region to foster trust and reconciliation that could help to bring an end to the appalling violence and bloodshed in Iraq as well.
Et de l'Irak en particulier, mettant fin à l'épouvantable violence qui ensanglante ce pays offrante la possibilité de relancer sa reconstruction et la réconciliation entre tous ses habitants.
In Europe, finally, Pope Benedict spoke of the two new nations, Bulgaria and Romania, which have recently joined the European Union. Past tensions in European nations, he stressed, must be overcome by promoting reconciliation at all levels. And he prayed also for a future of peace in the formerly war-torn Balkan region.
Sont des marques de la tension constante de son Saint-Siège pour la région des Balkans.
So many pressing concerns in different countries of the world, Pope Benedict said, should not overshadow the many positive developments of our modern age, especially the growing awareness of the importance of dialogue between cultures and religions. He noted also the increasing efforts to promote human rights and dignity around the world, especially through the work of the new United Nations Human Rights Council, which was established last year. Expressing his gratitude to former UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, Pope Benedict also encouraged his successor to that post, South Korean Ban Ki-moon, who was making his first official address to the UN Security Council in New York on Monday. But just what are the greatest challenges facing the new UN leader as he tries to promote peace and justice among this great family of nations? A question I put to the Holy See's permanent observer to the UN in Geneva, Archbishop Silvano Tomasi.
The new Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is a low-key person, but very serious and very committed. And I think he will do his own share of work in a fine way. He has to continue the process of reform of the United Nations. The last Secretary General Kofi Annan has supervised, for example, the change from the Commission to the Council of Human Rights. And that change has some shortcomings, even though it was heralded as the solution to all human rights problems. It's not, because the same countries that have political problems and human rights violation problems are sitting in the same council anyway, and there is a need to look at it in a more comprehensive and a more universal way, as representing not just the members of the council, but the whole body of the United Nations, all the countries, whose expression at the end it is. So to continue in the journey of reform of the UN, there are some administrative issues that need to be addressed so that money is spent more effectively and certain bureaucratic provisions are improved. But I think there are two or three specific issues where a lot of energy has to be invested. One is to make this peacemaking and peacekeeping force a reality, to make it an effective tool for the international community in the preservation of peace. So that needs to be, it's been approved in principle, has to be refined, has to be funded adequately, and to have the personnel trained in such a way that there will be no more scandals of UN soldiers abusing little girls or little boys even. Second, I think a good look has to be taken at the Security Council. The Security Council is a column of the UN system. So to touch the Security Council, it can be a risky business, because alternatives so far have proven to be of little value. So how to improve the participation of big countries into the system of security and the peacekeeping mission of the UN without creating too much of an earthquake in the system that we risk to destroy what we have without being able then to put back into place a structure that is equally effective or hopefully more effective. So this is the big challenge facing the discussion of reform of the Security Council. And so far, the whole debate has been paralyzed. But I think it will come back again. And we need to probably a qualitative jump to have enough imagination to come up with new formulas. So far, nobody has, even though there have been attempts to say this is a way or the other, this is another way. De facto, nothing has materialized. But this is one of the important challenges facing the new Secretary General. Then another one, I think, is again the question of development and poverty. There has been much effort to create in every single country a more coordinated UN team so that all the different representatives of agencies will work in convergence of efforts to impact the countries in a more constructive way. I think we need to do more in that direction, not just at the country level, but also at the international level, to have the different agencies of the UN to be a little more coordinated, some kind of coherence approach to addressing the same problems from different angles, but knowing what everybody is doing and knowing what will be the end goal to be reached. So these are some of the issues that I think will come up.
And finally, of course, the Holy See has observer status there at the United Nations. Are there any ways that you feel perhaps the Church can be a more forceful voice as the UN looks towards these reforms to making a greater impact on particularly the countries at local level?
It's true that the Holy See is the only observer state at the UN. And sometimes this is not understood by the UN or by the NGOs that are working around the UN, or by the state, individual states, because it's a unique kind of legal, juridical situation. The Holy See is a state. It's the only one not being a member. Yet there is a right for the Holy See to speak up at the UN and to participate in the activities of the UN and the negotiations of issues, to be present at conferences of the UN. The reason, obviously, given by the Holy See to explain its unique status is that it wants to remain above the fray and to be a little more neutral and to be able to say a word that has an impact at the moral level, so that it can be accepted and reflected upon by everybody, independent of religious, political interests of the moment situations. What we can do probably to be more effective and to have a wider impact, although right now when the Holy See speaks, even though people are not in agreement, the different ambassadors, the different delegations listens very carefully. And they want to know exactly what the position of the Holy See is on a variety of concerns. But we need to probably to have stronger delegations in the UN so that we have sufficient professional competence to be able to address issues knowing exactly what we are expecting, but within a wider ethical framework that reflects the values of our Christian tradition, which are values that are not limited within the confines of the Catholic Church or of the Christian churches, but they are values that really, at the end, respond to the good of the human person and of the human community as a whole family under God that has created us all equal.
Thanks there to Archbishop Silvano Tomasi, the Holy See's permanent observer to the United Nations in Geneva.